Good morning, y'all, or afternoon, or wherever you at. Welcome back to the Clinical Corner. So today what we're going to talk about is, you know, the highs and the lows of being a Black clinician, essentially. And I'm super blacked out today, you know, Black women matter, Africa's finest, you know, whatever. But I have a purpose. All right. So, we got our lovely Q with us again today. I forgot to mention, although y'all already saw her. But this one kind of hits home for me because I had a particular situation last week where I just feel like, for better or for worse, we need Black clinicians because we need somebody that's going to advocate for our children and the ones who look like us, you know. We all get the same schooling, but we don't all get the same upbringing. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of biases that end up happening to these kids or, you know, whatever population you work with. I work with kids. But a lot of biases that end up happening to these people just based off of what they look like. And to me, that's not fair, you know. Depending on the situation, I might be ready to get fired over it. You know, it just depends. So I guess my first kind of question for Q is, has there been like a time where you clearly saw some racial biases or something like that going on? And how, as a clinician, did you handle it? Did you do it in a professional way? Did you fly off the rocker? Like, sis, what's your method?
I did when I was interning, when I first started interning with my in my concentration internship. I was interning at a particular agency where I was getting both experience.
It was Montgomery.
Yes, it was Montgomery. I had I was dealing with both adults and dealing with children, with adolescents. And our adolescent program there was, you know, mainly Black adolescents. Mm-hmm. We probably had maybe one to two, maybe Caucasian adolescents. And so a lot of our Black adolescents, they were really reluctant to treatment. They barely even opened up, and I would hear some, you know, some, like, the director that was over it, she didn't want to admit it, but mm-hmm. she had some bias towards African American, you know, towards the adolescent kids, and she would tell me that, oh, you don't be so attached or so clingy to them and stuff like that. And I'm like, you know, Why not? I said, I know my boundaries. I said, why not build that type of rapport with these children? I said, because I'm just like them. I'm not too far from age difference from them. I said, too, if my clients, and I know it's a little stretch, if my clients feel comfortable looking at me as a big sister or aunt or a big cousin, that's how they view me. I'm gonna go along with that to make sure, build that comfortability for them to open up to me, because a lot of them were able to open up to me because either we were mm-hmm. close in age, I was looked at as like a big sister or a big, you know, cousin, or like, you know, I would look at to that extent. And so that was my advantage of actually getting that rapport with them to open up about things that they want to talk to this color about. And mm-hmm. so she didn't, I try to get her the benefit of that, but I kept telling myself, I said, I'm just going to be playing it honest with you, you know. And some of the kids that voiced that they feel like she was prejudiced. I said, they don't, you know, they're not going to open up to this. It's very weird that our kinds open up to this. I said, mm-hmm. depending on how you approach them, they're not going to open up to you for sure. I said, even with their own kind, we approach them in a way that's not approachable to them. That's belittling them or making them feel that their opinion or their feelings don't matter. This and third, or they just, you know, doing it because they want attention. Because that's how she made them feel. Whether you're Black or white, they're gonna, you know, be closed off to you. And so I had to tell her, like, you know, you don't want me to be this way with them. However, This is my form of technique of building that rapport with them. So yeah. If you don't like the way I do things and how, because then you see in my session, I'm getting more out of them than you are.
Always.
I say, so my way of therapy is working. My way of, you know, getting what I need to get from them is working. And I had maybe 3 or 4 of them to, like, you know, graduate from the program and never came back. I don't know what they're doing now. Now, since, you know, it's been years since I left that agency, but I even had felt like some type of she questioned my competence because I was new within the field of counseling. I had just graduated, hired me on. I was a dual therapist as the adolescent and inpatient adults. And I also helped work with, you know, outpatient as well. But it's like she questioned my competence and would make slight remarks. And I was like, you know, that's racist. Well, I'm not prejudiced. I'm not racist. My best
friend, I got black friends.
My best friend is black, and she was in my wedding. I said, that's every, you know, Caucasian, white, however you want to put it, excuse to not say they're not racist or prejudiced because they had one black person in their wedding. No.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not fair. And I feel like too, as a black clinician, we are, our competence is questioning, even sometimes by our own.
But see, here's the thing though. I think, and you know, y'all don't fight me over this. I think a lot of times we end up being better therapists and counselors or clinicians or whatever you want to call yourself. Because for one, we're a lot more approachable sometimes, because it depends on if you're on your high horse, but we can be a lot more approachable because, like, we didn't come from all this generational wealth and stuff like that. We're trying to build. So the kids just relate to us more. And for me, I can see, like, myself and some of the kids, like, oh, if I would have did this or did this, I would have been right here too. I just got lucky and had a good upbringing. But, like, a lot of times these kids are product of their environment.
Mm-hmm.
And
when you go back into the same environment that you came out of from what you were doing, it's kind of hard to practice what you have learned in therapy to do, because I'm going back to the same environment.
Right.
That's like
you built like all this rapport. So like my kids are inpatient. So they build all this rapport with somebody who they feel like looks like them, who they can relate to and all this stuff. And then you go home and you go back to the same old. So they kind of like close themselves back off. So me personally, like most, a lot of my children send me Facebook messages. The rule is they cannot add me as a friend, but if they need something, they know how to find me on Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
You can send me a message. You cannot be my friend.
And that's the thing about it. It's all about setting those boundaries. What people fuck understand, you know, everyone has their own form of therapy and how they are able to reach their clients. But you don't knock them for the type of therapy that you, because it's not your traditional type of therapy. Mm-hmm. And we're taught in school, you use your form of way of therapy to get in to reach your clients. However you see fit to reach your client, but you also have to set boundaries. And we all know that we have to set boundaries. That's part of it, you know, but don't try to belittle one's way of therapy because, you know, it just, we have to stop doing that because for one, as Black clinicians, you know, we do go hard for our clients. We do see, we want so much better for them. Sometimes it burns us out, you know? We get the statements of, oh, you're doing too much. You can't be doing more than the client. Yes, we're taught that. Can't be doing more than the client because you will burn yourself out. However, being the person that you may be, that you are before you are a clinician, kind of gets in the way of that, because when I'm a people person and I want people to do good, I'm just a good-hearted person.
I don't think I'm a people person now, because you know.
You ain't the biggest people person, but you are, you have
a care.
Yeah, you have a way, like, of, I guess, channeling that to a certain extent, but you're not the biggest people person, however. No one knows that based off of how you are when it comes to your clients, but I'm your best friend, so I know to a certain extent you're not the people to feel.
It's not even that, like, I'm not a people, I'm not a people person, but, like, I feel like I I'm like too inviting to like be super on everybody, because then I'm gonna like really burnt out, or like real like I'm gonna give everything to everybody else and then not give anything for myself, because I have a habit of trying to like help. I will help anybody with anything. Mm-hmm. That's just my nature. But if people know that's your nature, they mm-hmm. can, you know, manipulate you and kind of use you while they can and stuff like that. Or like one of the issues that I used to run into was like people basically wanting free therapy sessions out of me, because mm-hmm. baby, I'm good at my job. You know, I don't let nobody tell you that I ain't. Cause if
right.
cause they tell you that, then baby, that's a lie. But people know that I'm good at my job. So it's like, I have an issue. Oh, let me call Candace. And like, I'll be to not hear from this person in like 6 months, and you call me with like this heavy stuff.
I have to help you process, and I'm like, dang, like we could have been breaking this down small bit by bit. Yeah, you think about stuff. You don't try.
Not
to
even that. It's like, hey, Candace, how you doing? I'm great. Like, I think that for me, that's one of my lows. I feel like because people know my job, because people know that I'm good at my job, people have a tendency to like seek out therapy and like disguise it as, let me run something by you.
Please stop by 206 or but, come to the MDS office.
It's like I'm saying, and it's, and I want to say too, some people who are like that don't realize, you know, they're looking for someone who knows that's not so much good at what they do, but they know this is okay. This is what Candace does for a living, and if I know anybody can help me break down what's going on, she can do it. And it's nothing negating, like, you know, hey Candace, how you doing? Don't forget, but when to them, they might be experiencing a crisis. That's their considered their crisis. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. Christ thing. So we have this, like, I've had that with my family. When I was in grad school, my first year, I came home to visit. And my auntie knew I was in my social work master's, and now, you know, counseling is part of things we can do with our social work master's, right? So my auntie sent me to she sent me on a session with my aunt, my dad's baby sister, baby sister, Monty. And she I think I told you that she had a nervous breakdown. She had a memory, the father of her oldest daughter. Had, you know, did some fraudulent things, and people were trying to get her for it. And then so she had a mental break. So I went to her to this session, right? Come on, to like, okay, Quanitra, can you go with her? This session, okay, cool. Not expecting what I expected. So my auntie's talking, she's talking this childlike, she's reverted back to like she's about 5 years old, talking so childlike. She's in a
nervous breakdown.
And so her oldest daughter's outside waiting on outside because she had one that's stuff like that. So she's sitting there and the counselor who's talking to her, she's Caucasian, and I'm not knocking her back, but I just felt like she wasn't getting nowhere, Monty. So
if that therapist would have been a Black woman, it would have went differently?
Probably and probably not. I don't know, because I never been. This is my first that I've been to with her. So I don't know how she was in the previous. From my understanding, that wasn't her actual counselor. She was filling in for someone.
Gotcha.
So she really, I don't know. She must have time to actually get some details on my aunt's, her file and stuff like that. So she kind of was like, not really. So I told my aunt, because it broke me down, because I'm looking like, you know, I can deal with certain things, but I never would imagine dealing with it comes to family. I can deal with other people who I don't know, who I'm not blood related to, and be okay with, you know, things. I get emotional here and there at times when I do it, you know, when I do in my profession with, you know, other populations and stuff. But when it comes to my family, to see my aunt in that state, didn't know that she was in that severe state like that. And so I went to my aunt, I was like, don't you ever put me in that position again. I said, yeah, I'm not even finished with school yet. So what you thought this was?
I don't even have a degree, sis.
I was like, what did you want me? This, so my dad, I had told my dad, I was really upset. And so like I said, to see her like that, it was heartbreaking because I never know my auntie be like that. But to find out, one thing I did learn though, mental health, issues run in the women. It runs in our my grandmother's side of the family in the women. And I didn't know that. I have an aunt who, my grandma's half sister, she had a mental illness. Her my uncle had a mental illness, but it's mainly in the women. And if anything tragic happens to them or anything that really don't, they
you ever they seen mental state, The Silver Lining? It got Jennifer Lawrence in there, but essentially it's kind of like that. It's like schizophrenia, bipolar, traumatic onset kind of thing.
Right.
So like it's in you. And in his case, in the movie, it's like really rare that just because it's in you that it happens. But he walked in on his wife. It's one of my favorite movies, which is why I know the storyline like this. He walked in on his wife having sex with the English teacher at the school that they both worked at. And so he had a nervous breakdown. And then he finds out that he has, it's this long name for it. I think it's like bipolar onset traumatic event or something like that. But the movie is essentially about him getting his life back together. And then he meets this girl and they start like dancing, like literally they enter the dance competition. And like that was their coping skills. They kind of just used each other because she was like bipolar and schizophrenic and stuff too, because her husband had died on her. So it was just two broken people who came together and helped each other out. You should watch the movie. That's just my side.
I need to watch it, but that you know,
it's called The Silver Lining.
People do think because you are, you know, they really, and they don't mean no harm. Man, I'm pretty sure Monty didn't mean no harm. She just like, you know, she trusted me out of all of the, you know, nieces and nephews. Okay, you know, yeah, you know, accused in school and she's starting to do this, but I just need someone I know I can depend on to go with her and who understands what's going on. And
that's
and
one of my boundaries, though.
I get it, but I'm gonna like, yo, auntie, you could have. I didn't know how deep she was in this depression because, like, she gone. And I was like, Dad, don't they ever. And my daddy said, don't try to ever put my fucking daughter in that position again because, you know,
it's like, well, yeah, he did.
Yeah. He was pretty upset because I was upset and I was hurt because I still was in the learning stage of everything. And to see her like that, and like, I'm not coming home to, you know, enjoy family. I ain't coming home.
And then if you was in your first year of school, honestly, you hadn't really learned how to process stuff yet. You still.
Yeah. Like, I was still like, I just
theories and stuff.
I actually had just finished that first semester in grad school. Well, no, my second semester. It was that summer that I had went home to visit. And I was like,
I have one of my boundaries that I've had from like the very beginning is I can't therapy family. I knew pretty much from
it's a conflict of interest too, jump, like
that I wanted, like I was getting my social work degree so that I could do therapy. And so that I could just have a broader spectrum. And so I would always be like, you know, I'm not doing family. I'm not doing family, friends, anybody who I'm like super close with or like it's a conflict of interest to me. Because for me, it's a bias. I'm going to respond to you. I'm not going to be able to respond objectively. And my job is to be objective.
Not in these subjective. Things. Yeah.
So there's no way I can give you like some quality therapy or some quality even advice. Because I'm going to be like, let's say if it were my mom, I'm going to be like, okay, well, this is my mama, so this is what she needs to do, and this is going to be the best for her, but it may not be the best. It may just be what I think she needs to do because she's my mama. So I myself, that's one of my boundaries. It's always been one of my boundaries. Like, if anybody has, like, something going on, I would love to refer you to somebody else. Like, I will help you find places and stuff like that. I've went as far as like people who live out of town, like calling around, telling them, hey, you know, I like to boost myself up. I'd be like, hello, I'm Candace. I'm a licensed therapist. And I'm just looking to refer. And then I'll be like, one of my clients, they know it's my family. And I'm looking to refer one of my clients to kind of like get them in the door and make them, you know, seem like, and, you know, I give them some background information and stuff like that. And then that'll help. You know, I did that for one of my friends in DC.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he was like, that was dope. Got you, boo. Yeah. But like, yeah, I can't do it. Especially because like,
when my dad died,
I couldn't like be the therapist and grieve. And like, I feel like nobody outside of like my grandparents and of course like my household was like, how are you? But like nobody in Memphis other than my grandparents like truly asked me how I felt. You know, I felt like,
oh, she's the therapist, she know how to cope with it. No, that ain't always right.
Other than my cousin Carlos, like my cousin Carlos is the ace boom cone. Like, he gets all the praise because he, it's like he put me on his back to make sure that I was okay. But
that's good.
I think that, again, that probably speaks to one of what I feel like is low in being a clinician, is because people think you got it. People think that you can handle it. People think that they don't have to ask you. You're supposed to ask them.
Have you ever thought to the extent, like, when you think about Black clinicians and versus other races in the races in the profession, do you feel as though they think as African American clinicians we are strong enough to take on, like, we, it's not so much not we're, well, how am I supposed to say, we're looked at as we can handle certain things, like certain baggage or certain like situation because of what we went through as a race.
But I think that's just a Black people thing though. So I guess in short, yes. But I think that that's because they think that, that's why the whole strong Black woman narrative, I hate it. Like, I'm not strong, I'm feeble, I need some help too. Like, don't do that. Like, yeah. I don't want to be looked at as like the strong Black woman, because if I am the strong Black woman, like, who's helping me? And we all need some help. So
now, do you think Black female clinicians and Black male clinicians, they have a different obstacles they face, because, you know, as a woman, you know,
I don't know any Black male therapist, so I am not sure. I would like to think yes, they deal with different struggles, like same but different, because when you think about like a male therapist, you know, they try to teach Black men to, oh, be so strong, don't cry, stuff like that. A Black male therapist needs to have some sort of empathy and some sort of emotional intelligence. So he may be looked at as, you know, every, you know, Black people from the hood, if you cry, oh, that's some gay stuff or whatever, whatever. So I think that he may have struggles like that, where they may like try to take like notches off of his manhood because he has emotional intelligence, when honestly, that makes him more of a man than a lot of other men. So I think that, yeah, a Black male clinician would probably deal with the same kind of issues. But like, in a perfect world, I wish that we could open like a nonprofit, but it's only Black therapists, like, you know, BT Incorporated or something, Black Therapy Incorporated, I don't know. But like a safe haven for like Black people to come and get like some specific therapy on Black people stuff, because it's a lot of stuff that we deal with that other races may not have the empathy to deal with. Like, I have an issue with white people policing Black hair. A white person won't understand why that's an issue for me. but a Black person will. So let's say I had a white therapist and I come to therapy up in arms about somebody trying to say something about Black hair. That person may look at me and be like, it's just hair. And I'm gonna be like, sis, cut the session short. You can still get your little funky coins, but like, I can't do this today. But a Black therapist would empathize with me and understand that like our hair is our heritage. And like mm-hmm. people been policing our hair since slavery. Like, did you know? And like half my life goes back to slavery. But like they used to shave off Black women's hair and stuff like chairs with them. So you work on a cotton field, but you'd rather stuff your chair with my hair. Or like Black women weren't allowed to like braid their hair and show like their creativity because the white women didn't like that the Black hair was more, I don't know, fluffy, beautiful, whatever. I mean, you know, it's just, I wasn't alive during slave time, but from my understanding, the issue with hair was always that Black hair could do more than white hair. Mm. And so, like, I think it's important to, no matter where you work, to make sure that mm-hmm. you're speaking up on the issues of, like, if you see something that's racial or prejudice or whatever, you have to speak up for it. And I'm getting to a point now where I guess I value my Blackness more than I value my job. Because I'm not gonna bite my tongue about things that I feel like I'm like, nah, you wrong. Because if I don't do it, absolutely nobody will. And then that's how we end up in these environments that like the code of, you know, the Bill of Rights or the code of how they do things in that environment or that job or that organization is racist AF. Right. Because you don't have somebody holding these people accountable. So, you know, at my job, I'm probably the angry Black girl.
Not the angry Black girl.
And I don't care. Because I'm going to say what I need to say, how I need to say it, and I'm going to advocate for these kids because absolutely nobody else will. And that's just how I feel. People may think I move off of emotions or whatever, but in a way, yeah. But also, you know, for the most part, I try to be really professional with it. But like, if you take me there, I'm gonna go there. Right. And that's just what it is.
So I guess as because our as social workers, our main, you know, our main focus is safety as well as being an advocate for or that resource for mm-hmm. our clients, right? Yeah. So with that being said, it's. I can't stand for like you know, in your job description says advocate for your client, but then when I advocate for my client, it's like you try to no, then when my job description says advocate for
your advocate client, for my clients, you say I'm wrong.
But then I do, but yeah, but you tell me wrong. No.
So I always like whenever I give my little TED talk from Black History at my job, I always be like, in my opinion, I first start off with this is my opinion. And then I always end with, like, that's just my little tidbit.
Right.
So like, but what's in between, it could be at a 10, a 20, it could be at 100. It just depends on how much of it is an issue for me. So, like, back to hair, you know. Me working with kids in a residential facility who the ones who look like me need to get their hair done, right? Because if you got hair like mine, you know, today's a good hair day, I think, but like tomorrow may not be. So if you got hair like mine, you need to know or have the opportunity to get your hair done. So a situation occurred where a decree was sent down that the girls are not allowed to braid each other's hair anymore. Boy, it took me to the moon. I saw red, bruh. I was like, okay. And I responded immediately. And so that's what I mean when I say, like, I'm getting to a point where I just value Blackness more than I value my job. Like, I think I'm an asset to wherever I work. And if somebody wants to punish me for advocating for the children who look like me when nobody else will do it, well, we got one more person that'll do it because my good sis went to an HBCU. She's a white therapist and she went to an HBCU, and I love it because she'd be like,
"That's what's up."
She'd be like, "Yes, so this right here, we won't do it." So like, she like, you know, we usually have the same kind of
thing. She's been exposed, right. So she's able to.
I can say something and I might say it like stupid aggressively, and then she'll come back and be like, so what she means is, so like that works. But I just feel like, you know, it's my duty to make sure that like stuff like this is, you know, taken care of. And I just truly have issue with non-Black people policing Black hair. And it just, to me, that wasn't acceptable. And I think that that's one of the benefits of being a Black therapist or a Black social worker, a Black clinician, a Black whatever you want to be, because you can advocate for your clients based off of what you've gone through in your life, based off of the injustices that you've seen happen to you. And you can try to be that bridge so that it won't happen to them. And so that's why I love working with the girls and stuff like that, because they can learn from me, and honestly, I can learn from them. And I just think it's just a nice to be that young and see somebody who looks like you in what they feel is a position of power. I don't think I got no power. I just be chilling. But they feel like, you know, oh, wow, you're this professional. And I think that it's empowering to them, so that, like, I never saw myself working with kids. I was like, I ain't working with no kids. I don't like no kids. But I truly, like, enjoy it. Like, I love children, you know?
The one population that I was, you know, I enjoyed working with my allies when I was a therapist at my first agency. It just, sometimes, with Allison's inside, working with that type of population with substance abuse, it was kind of hard to sometimes reach them. And I felt burnt out when I couldn't get, you know, couldn't reach them because I wanted so much for them. But they, you know, they were at an age where they're going to do what they do until they fall hard in their behind. And then, you know, boom.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of the downfalls for sure, because you see so much potential in them, and then, you know, you can give it your all. I have this one, she's not here anymore, but like, I saw so much potential in that girl. And it's just like, she left and she ended up in the same environment, and she like right back to the BS. And she like actively seeks out help from me, but there's nothing I can do. Because she ain't with me. And so it can be disheartening, like, for situations like that, But then, you know, you have your success stories that make you feel better.
Look, and they were very funny, though. My adolescents were very fun. I had a good times with them, and I was able to do, now with adolescents, I was able to do certain, like, activities with them to get them involved, mm-hmm. and it made it, because it was boring. And that's what they didn't understand. They were boring when it came to teaching them certain things. Mm-hmm. You know, granted, you know, some of the kids were put there by like DHR or by, you know, by like, you know, the Department of Youth Services and all that stuff. Then they were put there, but if they don't have to be forced to come, make it interesting.
Make it fun. Okay, so listen.
They were so boring. I like boring. To
play spades with the kids. The kids love spades. And like, it's a group activity. So you play with them, play spades. You teach them how to work as a team. You know, we teach them how to talk across the board, you know, communicate without communicating, you know.
Right.
But, you know, just being creative with what you do. I like to paint with the kids because, you know, I'm an autist, Tony.
You have a big old activities room. We never did the activities room. So it's like, it's just like when I started doing things for the kids was saying, it's like they knocked what we were doing. I'm like, are they learning? Are they enthusiastic? Then what's the problem?
Here's the thing.
What's the problem?
We started doing a lot of things for the kids and it got banned. We're no longer allowed to do certain stuff for the kids.
And I don't like to work in, you know, when you are interviewed and they ask you what thing you want to bring to the table, what things, you know, that we do different that you want to do. And then when I start doing my own little thing, you knock it. It's like, which one do you want? Do you want to better your program so where you can get more clients and they want to come? And, you know, because, you know, people drop out of treatment and they come. And then, but when it gets boring, they don't think they get enough out of it, they stop. So my thing is you ask us these questions in our interviews, however, when we implement those things, once we hire, y'all want to take away from it. That's not fair. That's not right. If you're going to let me do my job and it works, or don't even hire me, let me, you know, I don't need all this micromanage trying to stick, you know, all this. I don't like micromanaging. I don't like all this trying to condense me into this bubble of yours and what you want, but you ask me to be a certain, you know, you want me to do certain things, but you want to put me in this, but no, we're not doing that.
I think that the more you push through and persevere, and like they see that like all this good stuff we doing is good for the kids, like it's an uphill battle, but I think it's a battle that we'll win because our success rates, specifically you and I don't know about everybody else, but I know your success rate at work is phenomenal, and you know, not to toot my own horn, but BB, my success rate is beautiful, honey. So, and I think it's because we do so much for the kids that, like, you know, they just see love and it's effortless, from us because we ain't really doing nothing. Like, playing spades makes them feel love. Why?
It's just
because you're paying attention to them. And you're allowing them to be in your space. Like,
and you have to watching come movies. To their level.
Exactly. And let me tell you, like, simple things when you work with kids, or honestly, adults too, make them so happy. Like, our girls on the unit wanted to watch ATL, child. When ATL went nowhere free, but it was $4. That means that either one person could pay $4 or everybody could pay $1. And they watched ATL. First of all, one of the women, she paid for ATL. And she paid for it, and she told them they had to watch it until it expired. And they were like, okay. They watched ATL on repeat for 3 days. And they was just so happy because she bought ATL for them that they didn't mind. They knew words. Like, one of them had never seen it, and she knew the words by the time it was done. Like, it's simple stuff. And I think that we just honestly got to keep going. Like, the lows are going to be low, but the highs are going to be so freaking high. And so no matter, like, when I have bad days and stuff like that, I try to hold on to the good days and be like, all right, today was a bad day, but like, this is something good that may have happened today, or this is something good that happened yesterday. You know what I mean? Right. So I just try to keep pushing and keep being positive and just keep doing what I'm doing. And I mean, people are going to decree down things and try to stop you from your greatness, but there's always a creativity factor to it. So, okay, right. You say, I can't spend any money. Baby, I got so many supplies in my office. That's cool. I can make something fun out of anything. I can make something therapeutic out of anything. I mean, a child can tell me they want to play Uno, and that's cool. Every number you put down going to be a different therapeutic question. And like,
right.
Does it annoy them? Yeah. But they get to play their game, and I get what I need to. And then at the end of the game, I have one who wants to play the same card game every week because he was like, I like it. Yeah, you make me answer questions, but I love answering your questions. So, I mean,
I think like that's the thing about therapy. You get to bring out your creative side to make it to make it interesting to want to learn. Cause it's like, you know, when I think that's the amazing thing about counseling. You can make it your own and you can bring out that creative side that you have when it comes to, I guess, you know, getting your client, you know, your client in tune or interested in therapy, what they're there for. And not making it seem like, okay, yeah, we know if this is an involuntary client and they're there because, you know, whatever going on with, you know, maybe
child the best like thing that, is when you have your involuntary clients and then they end up loving you and you'd be like,
yeah,
hey, friend.
Yeah. And I had a lot of that when I was in substance abuse, like those who came from like the HR, the court, like, you know, I gave them a hard time, but if I didn't give you a hard time, that means I didn't care. I went through the
substance abuse was my second favorite though. Like if I had to choose, if I only could choose two jobs, it would be substance abuse or working with kids, because substance abuse is rewarding AF. Especially
it's
like
amazing to see.
You see adults who like had no hope in doing better, and then you give them some motivation.
And they be like, you ain't even young as hell. What you know about life? You right. I am young as hell and I have not reached the milestone where you had in life. But you know what? We gonna learn the thing together because I'm learning from
you. He was like, you ain't never did no math. You don't know how it is. And I was like, you're absolutely correct.
I
have never did math. But, you know.
I know the book terminology.
And I was like, look, I read this book about math. And let me tell you what it do to you. And he was like, you know a lot about meth to not be doing it. I know. So like, I really just think it's about getting a connection with your clients. And once you have that connection, no matter what kind of life experience you have, then, you know, they'll help. And I do think my success rate with kids is a little bit higher than with adults. But like, I don't think I had a bad success rate with adults. I just think that it took longer to like a certain age group. Cause like I had some older adults who like, they look at you like, oh my God, this young girl and she's helping me. Like, I love it. Look at the new generation moving forward and stuff like that. But then you got people who are around your same age who might be like,
I had a client like that. That was like, we were close in age, and she was a little reluctant, but she came around and like she was very thankful for the therapy and what she gained from it. Because I think my success rate evens out because I only been in the substance abuse field, and I dealt with, you know, inpatient, outpatient. I dealt with Alice and then I dealt with adults. I know one thing I look like, women, some people say they don't want to work with women that's been substance abuse because they're so hard and difficult to deal with. You have to just know how to
deal with it. Not, though.
But it's not. But my thing is, I think my success rate was, you know, about probably the same. you know, I didn't have that much of adolescents in the, you know, our adolescent program at that agency wasn't that big.
It was tiny.
Yeah, it was.
It wasn't advertised well.
Exactly, it wasn't. And so.
It could have been so much.
I think the success rate of that, I believe my adult success rate was much more, probably higher than the Alice, because we really didn't have that much of an Alice program. But
I think I've also worked, my career has been surprisingly more children than adults. Because, you know, I started out in substance abuse and absolutely loved it. But then I got this other job where I made like just a little bit more money. And it was with kids, and I was like, okay, because my substance abuse agency was going down. So, you know, right. I had to get on out of there before, you know, I ended up with no job and like trying to shuffle and buffle. And that's how I kind of fell into working with kids. Mm-hmm. And when I moved here, I tried to get back into substance abuse. And I had a job in substance abuse, but it was like, I don't want to be cliche, but like this job kind of like pulled me in kind of sort of, because I had a job. I was going to work at a methadone clinic. I was so freaking excited. I was like, yes, back in substance abuse. Like the money was nice. And it just, you know, after I had my kid, like they wanted me so bad to where they hired me when I was still pregnant, knowing that I wasn't going to start until after my postpartum or maternity leave or whatever. And so I was just online looking for jobs one day because I was bored and I was tired of being in the house talking to a child that couldn't talk back to me yet. But if I can go back to them days, funny what you take for granted. So I was just looking for jobs and stuff like that. And I saw this one and I was like, ooh, that looks cool. And I got a call like within an hour. And I was like,
I got it. What you telling me?
I was like, they must really be in need. I was like, I don't know. It may be too good to be to what it seems. They're calling me that quick, but I'm going to go to the little interview. And I went to the interview and I knew I had the job. I went home and I was like, yeah, I got that job. And then they called me the next day and was like, can you come in for another interview? And I was like, I told you I had that job. And my other interview was just, have you found a daycare yet? This, and this. When you want to start? You know, it showed me around the doggone building and stuff like that. And so I didn't really find this job. This job kind of found me because it was one of those, I didn't even like do a lot to, it was click and apply on Indeed. So it was just like click, 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 click.
You know what I'm saying?
Right, just click and apply because I was just like, oh, okay, that's cool, you know, whatever. And then I think it may have been more money than that substance abuse job. So I was like, I mean, sure, cool. Click and apply. I ain't got nothing else to do. And, you know, I clicked and applied and it was what it was. You know, I think that for the time being, while I'm in this state, it was what I needed. I got to experience like immense highs, but like super lows too, because woo, the racist. But it helps me as like a clinician.
Be more aware, yeah. Being more aware of where you're at.
And it's taught me to really be an advocate for my clients and not just like talk the talk. Like, bro, walk the walk and be confident in your skills to know that you can say whatever it is that you need to say.
And won't be judged by the one that be recommended for it.
This gonna, and I know I sound like the cockiest person in the world this morning, but they need me. Like, so I just think that my talent has like really flourished in our field, in this job.
Right.
So it is what it is. I feel like this was such a good talk. It's probably time to wrap up now. So do you have like any final words, any words of encouragement for our people? Any like anything?
I would just say as Black clinicians, continue to be more aware of, of where we at when it comes to our profession, but don't dim down our light to fit anybody else. What works for us and connecting with our clients, do that. And if they don't like that, then maybe that's not where you need to be. However, just continue doing what you're doing. Because if it's working, continue to do what you're doing. Don't let no one say that. Don't let the world or haters or anybody dim you down what you're doing to connect with your clients, because at the end of the day, what you have put in place that works for you and your clients, it works. And that's all about what counseling is and what we are taught, that if it works for your client and you, and you get able to do what you need from your client, it works.
And then to piggyback off, you're not done. Go ahead.
Oh, no, you can go ahead.
I was going to say, to piggyback off of that, you don't have to be a clinician to advocate for your people. So, no matter what you do, where you go, I just want y'all to stand strong and make sure that, like, when you see or hear or come across something that you feel like is wrong, racist, discriminatory, whatever, speak
on it.
These people speak on need it. Us. And I was having a conversation the other day, and kind of like the conclusion that we kind of had to it was that the reason why professionally we're not progressing as fast as we want to is because when we see things that happen, we're like, oh, I don't want to say anything. I don't want to lose my job. I don't want to do this. I don't want to do that. But like, we don't know the reaction that's going to come when we speak up. If you lose your job, I mean, fuck it. You will get another job. But on the off chance that person listens to you, you just help improve an organization for longer than the life of your employment there. So no matter what you do, I don't care if you work at the doggone gas station, y'all matter too, because trust me, I need my chips and water. So, make sure that when you see something that's going to affect you or the people that you work with, you say something. And that's it. That's my TED Talk for the day. So, I guess Q already gave the closing words. So, of course, we thank y'all for listening. You can find us on Pandora. You can find us on Apple. You can find us on Spotify. You can find us anywhere, okay? You can find us on YouTube. You can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Instagram. You can find us everywhere. Okay. So, again, I'm Candace. And this is...
I'm T.
Ha! So, we've had a great time talking with you.
Bye. Love y'all. Be good.
Thank y'all. Bye.